Hello and welcome to recording number one of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. It is August 31st, 2021. Now, very interesting with Sea of Death, it is the first of the New Infinities novels. So I wanted to mention we're going to get some names that are not part of the normal Greyhawk lore. There was some legal reason Gygax could use some of the Greyhawk names, but others he had to change. So we're getting some different. That's why instead of Sea of Dust, it's called Sea of Death. And it's referred to as the Ashen Desert. So it is Greyhawk, but there's there are a couple of names that are not being used, and the alternates are being used. Now, I think we can find at some point a translation of these New Infinities Gygax terms for the Greyhawk campaign, and later on we'll get a, we'll be able to show what's what. Now, just before we start the story, there's an illustration on the inside cover. Well, actually, up against the title page. I'm not quite sure. Not quite sure right here what that illustration refers to. I haven't read the novel in a few years, but we will be, working that out. Now, there's also a map here of the western portion of the Flaness, and you will get some different there's some familiar names and then some names that are unique to the New Infinities novels. All right, now I'm going to start here on page 9. It is chapter 1. Now, it should be noted, this book is about 50 pages longer than the last two Gord the Rogue novels from TSR. All right, page 9, chapter 1, first paragraph. Hail to Gratz, King of the Abyss, chorused a throng of demons, in voices that chirruped, bellowed, grated, squawked, and growled. King Grazit, conqueror of Prince Ariax, a huge, multi-armed, snake-bodied demoness called in clarion voice. The Maya, succubi, and the menagerie of others there echoed the cry, raising a noise that would have been incomprehensible and horrifying to human or demi-human ears. All right, break right here. So, this is actually, now, we are going to deal more and more in these stories with non-primaterial plane, mostly in the Abyss. And it is much different from where TSR eventually went with Planescape. So here we're kind of getting the Greyhawk planes, Abyss and extraplanar stuff, and Gygax's view of them. So if you're not like going to adapt this to Planescape, this is the old way. This is what Gygax saw as, what the infernal regions would be like. Now, you notice here we've got a description of the voices of the demons. Chirruped, bellowed, grated, squawked, and growled. Then we have the name of one of the rulers of some area of the Abyss, Prince Ariax. And then we get that the voices raised by these Lamaya succubi and menagerie of others, their cries are a noise that is incomprehensible to human and demi-human ears. All right, I'm going to restart page 9, chapter 3. A huge ebony figure stood receiving the adulation. His smile was charming despite the fangs it revealed. This figure, his body seemingly carved from polished obsidian, raised a six-fingered hand. In but a moment, the horde of demons fell silent, and Grazit spoke. King, you proclaim me, and king I am. My recent victory over Ariex now extends our domain over fully 8 planes. We rule the heart of the abyss, and soon the rest will bow. Pausing for a moment to allow the disparate demons to issue their noises of accolade, the newly made monarch stood with pride and delight written on his dark face as the adulation washed over him. Then his demeanor changed ever so slightly. Enough, he thundered. The throng became still. The self-proclaimed king gestured toward a grotesque, hyena-headed figure on his right and spoke again. Honor belongs to our good right hand, Prince Yinogu. Cheer him as our new viceroy. Grazit roared, motioning for the demon to stand. And again the discordant chorus sounded. He waited for the initial outburst to peak and began subsiding, then cut off the noise and ordered Yinogu to sit again by lowering his hand. Give glory to our marshal, Lord Koschichi, bellowed Grazit, raising his left hand, and a massive demon stood on the king's left as this call for recognition was made, his jaundiced skin hairless, except for jutting bristles above deep-set eyes. The bandy-legged Koschichi leered and raised his huge iron hammer over his head. All right, break. So we've got 3 descriptions right here. Grass is a charming looking ebony, you know, almost obsidian skin demon. Now, I assume when they say charming, and I've seen them do pictures of Grass before, he has a very human appearance. So he is not like one of these more monstrously composed demons. Now, Yinogu is the demon lord of the gnolls, and he has a very gnollish aspect with a hyena head. Hyena head and skinny gnoll-like body. Then we get Koschichi, who sounds a little on the pig-like side. He's massive. He has bristles on his face, deep-set eyes, he's jaundiced skin and hairless, and the bristles are above his deep-set eyes, and he's bandy-legged. So, the very nice, you know, little descriptions here we're getting. I don't know, most of these tend to come out of Monster Manual 2, you know, most of these creatures were mentioned back there. And I'm not sure if every one of them was actually illustrated or not. There were quite a few in Monster Manual 2. Gygax still seems to be dealing with first edition AD&D. Alright, I'm going to restart. It's page 10, paragraph 3. Despite Grazit's command, only a faint hooting and gibbering of acclaim sounded. The squat demon was so loathsome that even the throng of lessers found it hard to voice applause. Koschichi seemed delighted at this, even though his round of applause, such as it was, did not last as long as Yinogu's had. By the time Graz lowered his left hand and Koschichi sat again, the noise had all but died out. Graz ended the silence with his next pronouncement. Prince Yinogu and Lord Marshal Koschichi will now accompany me elsewhere, the king said. At that, there was a babble of sound. The audience was clearly surprised. According to what he himself had announced years ago, Rast was being forced by an otherworldly power to remain here in Mazafuk-Rendon, 333rd layer of the abyss, for years and even decades longer. The new king allowed the demons an assembly of creatures who served him and his associates to continue their murmurings and mutterings for a short time, then spoke again. All right, break. So we learn that, and it had seemed that Grazit in the earlier novels, I think it was even mentioned that he was bound to his lair of the abyss, and quite a mouthful there. It's named as Mezafagradon. And most of the lairs, I believe, have individual names and used to have either individual rulers or were broken up among very powerful demons. So here we have Grast, and it said he's at this point controlling 8 layers. I think in Artifact of Evil, it might have been mentioned that he was controlling a great deal more. So I'm not quite sure where the timing is here, or if it's just been changed, or if I'm just not remembering correctly. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 10, final paragraph. "Silence," he bellowed, and the crowd obeyed. "You doubt me," Grast asked, and a stupid toad demon nearby gave a short croak in response. It was a harmless gesture, for the thing simply intended to indicate its acceptance of its monarch's claim, no matter if it was true or not. But Grast, incensed by what he saw as an affirmative answer to his question, raised his hand toward the offender, and a beam of black radiance shot from his palm. The demon shrieked as the bolt struck it, and its face contorted in agony. The thing's body arched, its muscles contracting so as to hurl it upward. The demon was disintegrating into a puddle of gore, even before what remained of its body touched the ground again. All right, so I'm breaking here. Here's another power of Grast. I wanted to stop here because, again, this is consistent with everything we've seen on evil creatures, is that they have this tendency just to kill their henchmen and their vassals with quick reaction. All right, now it's wondered here, is a question, with 8 layers, does Grast have the biggest kingdom in the abyss? Now, one, I'm not sure, but the other thing is that we don't know if the layers are actually of the same strength and size. We can see there's some planes that seem very small, like the Cat Lord's demise, Demzies. He seems to dwell in a fairly small kind of subplane. And here, you know, it's... we don't know if the 8 layers are extremely powerful, or what kind of size and strength each one has, and whether or not there are bigger empires there, you know. I believe one of the planes is simply a single massive creature who the very lands are, what's going on. Now, we're getting these pictures put up. One is the cover. It's an excellent cover. And it's from very much later on in the story, I believe, in The City Out of Mind, where Gord is attempting to get the third theopart. And then I believe the interior picture here before the title page inside, I think that is actually The City Out of Mind as well. And he appears to be fighting, a figure with his, he has a broken sword in hand. Yes, and that is, the cover of this is a very Mission Impossible scene. And then there's the picture of the map here. And across this map, you're going to notice there's a lot of place names that do not match up to the our lean map, because there had to be, excuse me, there had to be some name changes made. You'll notice that east of the Yeomanry is now the Sea King's Land. And that we have the Ashen Plains, and we have Yol. Instead of the Plains of the Paimnins, we have something else there. So yes, there's a lot of changes here, and there does, they are other names for things in the Greyhawk campaign. So while I'm all for, generally using anything that Gygax has written first, above most second edition material, these are things that have been changed, to keep Gygax out of court, I believe. So we do need at some point to go through and come up with, what these names actually refer to. The Ashen Desert is the Sea of Dust. And, we find out, all these different things. And you notice this is the first new Infinities Gord book that Chris posts here, June 1987. And the second book, the TSR book, is also 1987, but I don't know what month. It may even have come out after this book. I think the second book must have been a manuscript that was already sold to TSR, it was already in their possession, and Gygax had to let it be published by TSR. His New Infinities company may have already been up and publishing by this time. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 11, second paragraph. "No doubts now," said Grazd. "And the members of the assemblage not only remained silent, but fell prone in homage to their king." Grazd allowed a thin smile to play across his face for a moment before continuing. "Euron, our Lord Steward, will rule in our brief absence. Obey him or face my wrath upon our return." At that, Grazd turned and departed the amphitheater, a vast, seemingly natural bowl of nacreous material, with his attendant nobles and train in tow. After the royal possession came a stream of the demonlings that were Grazd's subjects, fluttering and hopping, slithering and flying, lumbering and rolling. The motley subjects raised a hideous din in Grazd's wake. Across and over ground, resembling opals, they trod and soared and crept, leaving the pearly surface theater of audience to swarm across the park that surrounded that place. All right, break. So we get introduction to Viron, who's basically like my favorite character here. Of the demons that introduce, he's a very interesting character, and we're going to hear a lot more about him. But he is Grazd's steward, and he is kind of the one who whispers advice into Grazd's ear. All right. Then we get this little description on this plane about this amphitheater where they're meeting, and that it is covered in what appears to be opals. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 11, and it is the final paragraph. "Their king paid no heed to their noise or their trampling of the delicate ferns, nodding blossoms and flowering shrubs that covered the landscape of the park. If all of Mesophagradon were as disconcertingly beautiful as the royal Demzin, then this tier of the abyss would be indeed a paradise. Translucent trunks of a luminous dove-gray hue supported luxuriant leaves of shining black, gently waving and soughing in the little breeze that played through the tops of these weird trees. Beneath the palms and cedars grew thick, soot-colored grasses, and riotous profusion of tropical vegetation in shades of gray and ebony. Rainbow-hued insects and birds filled the exotic jungle. Monkey-like creatures leaped around the upper foliage, making streaks and flashes of yellow lemon and electric blue. Brightly colored deer and other smaller creatures bounded and scampered amid the black vegetations, their coats shining as if they were covered with jewels. Vulture demon fell upon a nest of peacock-like birds, gleefully rending and tearing adults and chicks. A baboon demon playfully chased and beheaded several monkeys, using claws and teeth to accomplish its sport. Bloody destruction spread in a swath across the paradisical gardens of King Grazd, and the monarch smiled benevolently as he viewed the sight. And one's subjects are frolicking in play, the handsome ruler noted to those around him, and no other mischief is brewing. With a slight turn of his head, Raz got the attention of the tall, stick-like demon, who walked several respectful paces behind him. Lord Vuron, he said, be sure to restock our parks, and add some larger, noisier creatures for more sport, too, while we are gone. In fact, you may declare a chase in our name. The leathery-skinned Vuron bowed in Grasset's direction before he responded. You are masterful in your entertainments, mighty king, said the steward. Your generosity and thoughtfulness will be praised by all. Break. Now, typical, evil behavior and demonic, but it should be noted, imagine... Rome and the carnage that it had in its arenas, where they routinely, besides battles of humans, they routinely had, terrible things happening inside that Colosseum. So, even though this is supposed to be the descriptions of the most evil creatures, they are very reminiscent of our own history. And here, it's kind of just like the reversal thing again, where what is good is bad, and what is bad is good. So that there is this idea in Jack Vance's Dying Earth that this very thing is very popular. To use that theme of the opposites, where things really changed. Now here's a little comment posted by Chris here about Gary and Gary Gygax. Gary gave up on movies when he was told the Blooms were in debt $1.5 million and wanted to sell the company. He saved the company by publishing Unearthed Arcana and Saga of the Old City. Earthdark sold 90,000 copies in July 1985, and Saga of Old City sold well, too. Unfortunately, he also hired Lorraine Williams. Williams bought the Bloom Brothers stock and took over the company. Gary resigned in October 1986. So here we are with 1987 for both Artifact of Evil and for this Sea of Death. So we can see that Gary was already gone by the time both of these were published. And of course, New Infinities was his next creation, which TSR and Lorraine Williams went out of the way to bring to court and destroy. All right.
Yeah, I never knew that he was trying to save the company when he wrote the Gord books. I never knew that was the response. I mean, I read that today. It was on Wikipedia, and what I posted there is just the synopsis of like three or four paragraphs that they have up there. But it's the heart of it and the interesting part. And I thought it was really cool that he wrote that then. It might explain why some of it seems rushed and hurried.
Yes. And, you know, there was already this overthrow in the works there. You know, the Blooms had been wanting to get out of it, and it's such a shame. Bloom's father invested early on when what had happened was one of his friends who was invested in the company died. So he needed to get another investor. And he went to the Bloom's father, and the Bloom's father insisted that the idiot brothers join the company. And unfortunately, Gygax, he really became enamored with, you know, the TV show and the potential D&D movie. And he was, you know, out in California enjoying himself while the Blooms were practicing, you know, various forms of incompetence. And they got the company into fairly deep debt. I mean, $1.5 million, you know, that's a lot back then. But still, you know, the company was still bringing in lots of money. And one of their big problems was overproduction. I had heard from some of the people from back then that what they did, they had warehouses full of first edition books, you know, like the DMG. They had a whole warehouse full of them because they were just seeing that they had room for expanding. And that's one of the reasons I seriously doubt they would ever have done second edition. I think they would still be looking to expand upon first edition, but keep those books as the core books so that they could sell them to, you know, a growing, fan base. And while, you know, D&D really had expanded by the mid 80s, there was huge potential for more to come. I don't know, you know, it's just, the company, I was told that they primarily saw core books as where they're going to make the money, and that it was very hard to make money on adventures. So I was told by Ryan Dancy back as third edition was coming in that their main goal was to sell core rule books. And of course, once they did third, they quickly did 3.5 and dumped all those Rule 3E rule books, and then they made another batch of money. And I always wondered if when they came out with 4th edition, they were actually looking to, reduce the popularity of that book, and then come out with a 5th edition that would again sell more core rule books. It's a very strange thing when a creative project becomes a corporate project because their value system changes so greatly. Now, Saga of Old Sea really was the first Greyhawk novel because previously you only had Andrea Norton's Quag Keep and the sequel, which was even less well known. While Andrea Norton, she was a wonderful writer, she was not a great Greyhawk writer, and I'm not a big fan of those, and their connection to the Greyhawk campaign, I never indexed them because I felt they were really just too off center, and didn't provide much more. And then in competition with Gygax's Gord novels, they started coming out with Rose Estes's Master Wolf, her Master Wolf series, which was 5 or 6 books. And they were not good. I don't know why they just stuck with one writer or why they chose Rose Estes and didn't try to encourage either fan writing or go the way of hiring somebody decent to write a Greyhawk novel, but they didn't. And we've never really had too much written. I believe there's only about, including everything, there's only about 22 or 24 novels set in Greyhawk, and that includes the 7 Gygax and the 6 six or so Andrea Norton. That's half of them right there. So there really aren't tremendous amount of more than half. Really not a tremendous amount of Greyhawk fiction out there. And then you see how much fiction comes from everything else. Forgotten Realms, Dragonlance, Ravenloft. They're all heavy with fiction.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. Dragonlance took off, I think, around a similar time. And they apparently got all the acclaim, or most of it.
Yes, and, you know, but of course it became what crushed, bankrupted TSR was Lorraine Williams' misunderstanding of how the book publishing world. And instead, I believe what she did was take a greater amount of money up front, failed to understand that it was normally a lesser amount of money, but the publisher, what she had is books published for her. And normally you would go to a publisher, and what the publisher would do is they would give you a certain amount of money, but and you'd get some royalties, but they got the lion's share because they were going to accept any returns. So she did not understand then that she did not sell those books completely to the book chains. Every contract like that, the books, any unsold books, either are destroyed with the cover stripped or else they're sent back to the publisher. So all of a sudden, Lorraine Williams had all this money she'd made. And then when the books didn't sell, she had all these returns and had to pay the money back. And, you know, it was a very, it was an incredible mistake. It was almost, it was very much what the Blooms did by overprinting. Lorraine did with overpublishing. And it was really, it wasn't that there were too many campaigns out there. It was simply, from what I understand, the book publishing end that really bankrupted the company. And then Peter Adkinson, who had come out with Magic the Gathering, bought, D&D. And he obviously wasn't really enthralled with Greyhawk, because during the Wizards of the Coast, before they were bought out by Hasbro, they really didn't do much do too much with Greyhawk at that time. All right. I am going to restart right here. I will say we've gotten a description here of a physical description of Vuron. We have, like I said, the good is bad, bad is good, where a beautiful garden is there to be destroyed, and, beautiful animals killed, and that is, to Gratz, that is entertainment and sport for his minions. And, what I would say, though, is Gratz is doing this, and Vuron compliments him on his generosity and thoughtfulness. And I doubt very much that these evil creatures, if they're anything like Grast or Obmi or any of the, or Uz, they will not see generosity, and they will not have those decent characteristics. So I wonder here if Vuron is being a little sarcastic in what he is saying to Grast. And yes, and it's commented we'll be talking a lot about Vuron in the next few weeks. And other than Knight Errant, which jumps back to in time, as the it's an anthology of short stories, and I think maybe City of Hawks, because it's retelling. I think that we're going to hear a lot about Vuron in Dance of Demons and Come Endless Darkness as well. I just say here that Grass does not appear to be the smartest of demons, and Vuron appears to be, exceptionally intelligent. I really think here the comment about generosity and thoughtfulness is a sarcasm that Grast fails to notice. All right, I am going to restart. It's page 12, second paragraph, from the end. Of course, Grast said in a matter-of-fact tone, Koschichi, a demon accustomed to frozen waste and frigid winds, was sweating profusely in the tropical setting of the king's domain, and his stench was clearly repugnant to many of the creatures in his vicinity, even as repulsive of they themselves were. But Grast, delighted with his surroundings and his situation, showed neither any sign of being put off by Kotchisi's odor, nor any concern for his new marshal's discomfort. Surrounded by beautiful succubi and lamayas, Grasset entered the many-portioned gold-bedecked sprawl of his palace. Prior to his departure, the king would be the host and guest of honor at a royal banquet to celebrate his recent triumph. Victory heralded far greater accomplishments to come, and Grast reveled in his thoughts as he considered what the future would bring. All right, now, so Koschichi is accustomed to frozen waste and frigid winds. Now, I don't know. It sounds like he's from one of the, another plane, another layer of the abyss than Grast. Now, I don't know how many of these layers, say with Yanogu, I don't know if they actually controlled layers or whether they were just conquerors. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 13 in the second paragraph. Ambassadors of the kings of the tiger and wolf tribes are awaiting your pleasure, Lord of Evil. The priest spoke these words haltingly, humility dripping from every phrase, as he addressed the withered old man who sat facing him. Emperor of Evil, thundered the old man, his chest heaving with the effort. High priest Moto Kodos, chamberlain of his god Uz, threw himself prone and begged for mercy, writhing in fear. After the priest had engaged in a sufficient amount of groveling, Uz excused the error. You are useless and stupid, Moto Kodos. But I must make do with the poor tools given to me. Now go, fetch these filthy nomads to stand and pay homage to me. Such continual demands are wearisome, but we will bear up staunchly under them. As the trembling chamberlain rushed to do Uz's bidding, the form seated on the massive heap of bones and skulls that formed his throne seemed to flow and change. One minute he was a wrinkled, toothless old man. The next he was a massive demonic monster, a cambion, as those of his ilk were called, with pale reddish skin and pointed fangs lining his jaws. This form is more suitable for fools such as these barbaric horsemen, Uz muttered to himself. Subjects of his in attendance were too far from his chair of state to hear the remark, and it was not intended for their ears. But they would have certainly voiced their agreement with his statement if they had overheard. In the past month, Uz had received homage from the petty rulers of the bandit kingdoms, tribute from the hold of Stonefist, submission of all the chiefs who remained in the land that once belonged to the Horn Society, and the respects of a seemingly endless stream of humanoid leaders who had come to swear fealty to Uz as their liege lord and deity. Now, with the deputation of the wild nomad horsemen of the tiger and wolf tribes to the north, came the greatest triumph of all. These human savages were served to weld Uz's whole scheme into hard reality. Cambion chuckled happily just as the Chamberlain's voice rang out from beyond the entrance of to the royal chamber. Emperor Uz, Lord of Pain, and soon ruler of all Earth, proclaimed Modu Kadas. The echoes of his shout still remained as the fur-draped nomad warriors entered Uz's chamber to pay their homage. Uz accepted the ambassador's words of praise and gifts, bestowed presents upon them in return, and delivered his usual message in the form of a lecture demanding their unswerving loyalty. With the admonition that the riches and favors he had granted be taken away just as easily, and that would not be the end of the punishment visited upon anyone whose devotion was found lacking. The ambassadors left then, and soon the vast hall was deserted, except for the lowly, vaguely humanoid demons that stood permanent guard therein. Emperor Uz had gone off to hold counsel with those who now considered themselves his peers, but who he vowed would soon enough be his subjects, just as surely as all the nations of Earth would eventually bow to him. All right, break. Now that's an interesting little turn here. I really would never use it in my own campaign. I'm not sure of Gygax's thinking that the tiger nomads and the wolf nomads would ever bow to Uz. Now, as I remember, they were both dedicated foes of Uz in the past, and also a thorn in his side. Now, since the second artifact, the second key, is in at least the possession of his allies, Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy, I just wonder if they've dealt a crushing blow in this version of Greyhawk. Now, as we go further, Gygax takes us, you know, outside what is a long-lasting campaign. So I'm not quite sure. It from the beginning with Gord, I've always wondered what his goal was, you know, with the Artifact of All Evil and Tharizdun, whether it was originally to, send Tharizdun back to sleep or worse, maybe even elevate Gord to some kind of godhood, and show, you know, a character rising from an orphan, all the way up to being able to take on the ultimate evil. It's not my style. I'm not a high-level DM, and I don't play in high-level games, and I don't enjoy I don't particularly like Gord's story. I don't particularly like the Gord character. And I find this part right here odd, that he would have wolf nomads and the tiger nomads make allegiance with Uz. I can believe it from the bandit kingdoms, that if they're presented with overwhelming force, that they would certainly, you know, I don't think they're going to resist as much, but I have a very hard time seeing it coming from the nomads. So, but it is, it is part of Gygax's thought. So I'm definitely seeing that. I'm not sure of what he thought the alignment initially put the alignment of the wolf and tiger nomads down. I find it strange, too, that they're supposed to have animosity. So it's strange that both ambassadors show up at the same time in a way. I'm not a favorite of this, but it is certainly how Gygax is expressing the campaign. This is like the end of the last book. They've destroyed the Heroes of the Horn Society. And I always felt when they did that in Greyhawk Wars, that it was a terrible, terrible move. I've never really taken to the Uz character. I like the Heroes much better. And I've always seen the Heroes as somebody you could actually take on in regular combat, have low and mid-level adventures with, whereas Uz, who they make into a demigod, really disliked that. I loved the fact that we really didn't see interventions of deities in the Greyhawk campaign. Maybe they're avatars, which I'm not fond of, but I think this, you know, I know where the books take us, and I just wonder how much of that was in his mind at this point after he had been forced to have to not use all Greyhawk the way it had been written. I just wondered if he had decided by book two to just destroy the campaign, because this is a very, you know, this set of stories really is a tragic story in the end. All right. So I am going to restart. It is page 14 and the final paragraph. Shape without form, illumination without light, events occurring in timelessness. Such was the nature of the null space brought into being by Yggdrasil, or so it was perceived by those with her. Perhaps the greatest of witches, as she was known by some, actually did create this no place, or perhaps she merely enabled herself and the others to gain access to it. The truth of this was unimportant. What did matter was that Yggdrasil had provided the means by which she and the other practitioners of evil could meet. The witch was incredibly ancient, older even than old us. In fact, Yggdrasil was the mother of the Cambion, who had designs on all of Earth. Yggdrasil's infamy reached beyond Earth to other worlds that paralleled it and occasionally touched it for a time. Yggdrasil, she was called on one of these worlds, Louie on another. No matter what name or title she was, mother of us, worker of malign plots against those of good, and sometimes evil, she sat at ease and in comfort, now displaying the voluptuous beauty of one of the forms she was capable of taking. Perhaps this was Yggdrasil's true appearance. Be that as it may, even so gorgeous a face as the one she wore now could not mask the evil that dwelled within her. All right, break. Now, I'm not sure the Yggdrasil comes from. I think that's just something Gygax made up. Louie, on the other hand, is the great evil witch of Finnish mythology. And the Kavala talks a great deal about Louis. And now, the Slavs, they took the Finnish mythology, and they turned Louis into Baba Yaga. So, in my campaign, Yggdrasil in Blackmoor, I have her originating in Blackmoor as Louis. And then named Yggdrasil by the people in the Flaness. But some people, she's also known as Baba Yaga, and in that form haunts different marshes. And that's my campaign. But I do like it that we have here in Gygax that he does name her Louie. All right. And like I said, you can find, it's a great, great tale if you ever get a chance. It's been translated several times, the Kavala. It's wonderful. It's actually to the pace and rhythm of Hiawatha. And Hiawatha is the version of the Kavala written by, well, I'm not sure, is it Longfellow? I forgot who wrote Hiawatha. All right, I'm going to continue. It's page 15, and it is the last paragraph. With her, and with is the only method of describing location in such a nullity as the place she was, for no directions existed, no places, no discernible order, were others. Buzz was here, proud and tall in his demonic form, wearing finery and bearing his massive sword. Also here was a pulsating mound of fungi, upon and around which hopped and crawled a large toad, a exceptional ugliness. The mound was none other than Zuckmoy, demoness queen of fungi. As his lady, his ally, and his ruler, Cambion would have sneered at this last suggestion. Eggville would have laughed at it. Zuckmoy would have made no comment whatsoever, for she too was what she was. In the same no place as these three beings came three others, absent one instant and present the next. Jet black Grazit, hyena headed Yanogu, and discussing Kaschichi. Just as those who were separate from these three carried weapons, and who knew what else in their arsenals, each mighty demon on the other side bore implements as well. Rast his undulating bladed sword, Inogo his renowned flail, Kaschichi his favored hammer. The gathering was a tense one at best, and a hostile one at worst, as these tokens of death so visibly demonstrated. Mutual trust among such beings as these was inconceivable, and all of them knew it. What we've got a description. Now, I believe we all knew. I wasn't sure before about Grazit's undulating bladed sword. Chris asked Louis from the Kavala. Yeah, the Kavala. It's the ethnic origin story of the Finns. It's considered mythology, but it really was once, their religious text. And it's kind of like, the Norse, what they call Norse mythology, was true religion just 1,000 years ago, worshipped and believed. And then there came the Harald Fairhair, who converted everybody to Christianity by killing anybody who didn't accept it, right through the northern lands, and then the islands, and eventually to Iceland itself. All right. So I like this little bit, this little description Chris has put up the link to Wikipedia about the Kaleva, the Finnish ekbook Kalevala, and it's very interesting. I'm not quite sure that is exactly what's going on from that Wikipedia entry. One of the things that is very interesting about that is Mordenkainen's name is very Finnish. So it always made me wonder if Mordenkainen had actually come from the same area as Yggdrasil or Louis. All right. Now I'm going to restart. We're getting near the end here, and I'll read a little more. This is page 16, paragraph 2 from the top. After a series of curt introductions and acknowledgement, Razik addressed us directly and got right to the heart of what he assumed the conclave concerned. "The object is mine by right, and you will deliver it forthwith," said the self-proclaimed king in a thundering tone. "I shall do nothing of the kind," Uz shot back disdainfully. The bandy-legged giant and the lowering hyena-headed demon both made menacing gestures toward the Cambion as he uttered this rejection. A wave of menacing thought flowed from Zuckmoy, and a soft warning from Yggdrasil checked all of them. Rast frowned slightly, but then smiled and spoke again. "Son and Prince of Earth, be not alarmed at my demand," he said in what passed for a soothing voice. "It is most reasonable. Remember that had I not assisted you, you never would have come as far as you have. The object is one which I wrested from peril with dear Queen Zuckmoy's aid," interjected Yggdrasil. Ignoring the scowl that came over Grazit's countenance, the great witch added, "As mother of us, I must have full right in deciding the disposition of the item in question." "That's right, dear," gurgled Zuckmoy. "Don't let that stupid male push you around." "Stupid," roared the black demon prince, barely able to control himself. Yggdrasil was not impressed by his outburst. "It is stupid to ask our offspring for a tool you know he needs for the little things he still must do," she pointed out. Brass gritted his fangs and said, "Your choice of the word little is apt indeed, Yggdrasil. There is a question of whole planes at stake, and you and that amorphous pile of..." "I'll show you just how amorphous you can be," Zuckmoy boomed, as she grew in the space of 2 seconds into a massive fungoid shape resembling an elephant. Even as she did so, a pool of glistening slime began to come into being, gathering at her pseudopodial extremities. "The treaty is broken, you know," Nogu barked in his giggling hyena-like basso, as he noted the growing mass of repulsive stuff. "Aware," King grasped, "the bitch is bringing in her kin's demon, Shuzblocks." At that, Grass began shouting syllables that made the air shimmer. As he did this, Yggdrasil and Uz likewise uttered rasping, throat-twisting words. Major demons, minor ones, humans, and dark elves began to pop into existence all over the null space that had formerly been tailored for the presence of no more than the original 6 beings. The nullity stretched and shifted, trying to accommodate the sudden influx of new residents into its nothingness. Non-color of a different sort began to appear, running in veins and seams such as those that appear when ice begins to crack or rock develops fissures during an earthquake. Upon seeing the effects of what she and the others had wrought, Yggdrasil thought better of trying to fight. The battleground itself seemed to be in jeopardy from this venture, and if it collapsed, who knew what would happen to its occupants? "Stop! We will all be destroyed," the witch cried out in warning. Rats, realizing the same thing that Yggdrasil had perceived, ordered his servants to desist, but not before Katshi and Yanogo had each slain a pair of demonlings. In the same short span of time, Shuzblocks had entered and otherwise ruddy rudely handled several of the rampaging minions summoned by Gratst and his allies. Then the melee ceased. Most of the figures that had been called by the principals winked back out of the no-place, returning to wherever they came from. When the shifting and shaking of the no-place had ceased, a few of the lesser demon spawn on each side still remained. A cluster of Lamias and Succubi floated behind into the sides of Grazd and his cohorts, and an equal-sized group of vulture demons and toad demons arrayed themselves in a rank behind Zuckmoy and Uz. Yggdrasil was off to one side, seeming slightly closer to Uz than to Grazd, but still arguably holding a position between the two, instead of being grouped with the former. All right. So I'm going to break right here. There's great material here about the transmation and the fighting. Gygax does a good fight and good scenario right here, and we can see that demon summoning business and what they're able to do, how much that is a part of their offensive and defensive capabilities. And, you know, it's always been noted that that demon can summon another and another and another. But really, with Yggdrasil and her second artifact, Gratz, Yanogo's, Katshi's, Zuckmoy's, and even Uz's natural powers, they really do outweigh anything else. I mean, like having a few Lamia and Succubi behind him is not really impressive on Grad's part. You know. Yep. And this, I think, was a wonderful start to the book. We're not, while we are not dealing with Greyhawk right here, we are dealing with Abyss, and we get more information in this book and others, than we I think we'll ever see about this version of the Abyss anywhere else. All right, it is 7 o'clock. It's time to go. We're going to leave everyone and kick Craig out, and we will be done with recording number 1.